This is my first chance to meet almost all of you in the room tonight, and I got a chance to spend a bit of time with Julie and Parker ahead of this evening. It was so wonderful to meet them. They really do have an incredibly long association with Swarthmore and with the University of Chicago, which is another school that's great. In fact, I think probably the ideal must be a Swarthmore undergrad, a U of C grad degree. I think that's my ideal education. There you go. You have, some of you have it. How about that? As Julie said, this is really to be a conversation. I want to hear from you your experiences of Swarthmore, what we should never change. I want to hear about your hopes and your concerns and your dreams and your aspirations. I am spending a lot of time this year learning the stories of Swarthmore, learning its values, learning your visions. I hope that over the course of this year and into next year, we can craft a shared vision that will allow us to govern together the school, that will allow us to move into the future, that will allow us to deal with all the difficult budget issues that are in all of higher education today, and certainly at Swarthmore, but will also allow us to imagine forward as we have the responsibility to make sure the school continues its long and wonderful history into the future. So I'm going to make a few comments, and then I'm going to throw it open. And I'd love to have questions, but I'd really love to hear about your hopes, dreams, experiences, aspirations, and concerns. And this is just the beginning of a conversation. I am traveling around the country this year, but these are just conversations to begin. We have a blog and a website. We're very technological right now. And in a few days, we will post some reflections on tonight's event and encourage all of you to go on and add your thoughts. Please feel free to email me or write me or call me or come and see me at any time. I want to learn about your experiences and your thoughts. So just a few impressions. For probably since the early 90s, I have kept a file. I guess it's my hopes and dreams file. It's a collection of essays, favorite essays on higher education and on the liberal arts. In 2001, I found this essay. I just happened to find it. It was entitled, The Meaning of Swarthmore. This essay, and some of you have probably read it, has in bold, kind of dancing across the pages, a series of statements. A tradition of excellence, a community of learners, potential and obligation, unlimited opportunity, the excitement of ideas, a better and more humane world. So this essay in 2001 became the center of my file. It summarized everything I believed about what liberal arts education ought to be. And though it became kind of the anchor in that file, I had no idea then that I'd be standing here tonight joining you in living out these files, these values, in thinking about responsible planning for the future, in figuring out how we are stewards of this tradition. Every day now I get to see our students and our faculty and our staff live out the values on campus. The incredible excitement of ideas in the classroom. The unlimited opportunity in research where students, undergraduate students, are pioneering research with faculty. The potential and the obligation in the academic program, including the honors, but not limited to it. Students and faculty and staff living out these values. And now I'm getting to have some sense of the alumni and how you live out these values in your professions, in your communities, in your work around the world, in your daily lives. And I've learned enough already to know I shouldn't do what I'm about to do, which is I'm going to lift up just one alumnus. 2 weeks ago, I was in San Francisco, and I met a young man. He came to the San Francisco reception, Dom Seghello, who has written a book, 140 characters. Dom, class of 96, was one of the inventors of Twitter. And in the evening conversation, somebody asked about kind of the information overload and how we were helping students deal with just all this information. And Dom stood up and talked about being one of the founders of Twitter and how all of a sudden he realized he had an incredible responsibility about this overload. And he quit his job and he's written this book. And he talked about how the Swarthmore spirit, the intellect, the writing, the courses, and the sense of taking responsibility all contributed to the sense that he had to write this book, that he had to help address the problem that he himself had helped to create, living out his values. And on Friday, he came to campus to talk with our students about Twitter and our students' sense of responsibility. I get to see the students live out these values. It's really amazing, an incredible thrill to watch these students on campus. You know, at Swarthmore, just the sheer rigor of learning is joined with the sense of incredible academic adventure. And I watch as the students combine discipline with creativity, hard work with intellect in the courses, but also outside of their courses. They do it in a pterodactyl hunt. They do it with a primal scream during finals. They do it in arts and athletics in over 100 social clubs. They're having fun and they're learning how to build community. So one student last year who graduated was Caitlin Malarkey. Caitlin is our sixth Rhodes Scholar in 9 years. Not bad for a small school. Caitlin is now at Oxford, where she's working on her intellectual passion, which is public health and virology, the implications of virology for public health. Caitlin is a phenomenal scholar and a very active student leader. But when she wasn't in the class or the lab or giving some student leadership around campus, she was a phenomenal athlete. She was the captain of the women's soccer team in 2007 and 2008. That soccer team won those 2 years, the ECAC South Region Finals Championships. She was also a track star. She has set 4 track records. Now, the story I love about Caitlin is that during her honors exam, as she was getting ready for it, she realized that the steeplechase, a national steeplechase, was to be run in Ohio on a Friday, and 3 of her exams would be in Swarthmore on a Saturday. What to do? She and the faculty busied themselves in figuring this out. They even thought they might have to have her finals at the airport restaurant. They finally got it solved. She ran the steeplechase, flew home, took her honors, and graduated with high honors. Once again, living out those values. My impression of the faculty is that their faces light up when you ask them about their teaching. The hours our faculty spend inside and outside the classroom with our students is incredible. In September, I got to go to a science fair where 68 students showed their posters. Posters on the bleaching of coral, the annotation of music, the transmission of HIV virus cell to cell. One student even had a poster about a new species of bacteria she believes she has discovered. These students doing groundbreaking research, publishing papers with faculty, they're undergraduates. The time, the energy, the commitment, the partnership on behalf of the faculty is amazing. So over the summer, before the students and faculty got back, I spent a lot of time reading about the history of Swarthmore, something I'm continuing to do. So if you've got your favorite books, let me know. I read about these phenomenal presidents, Parrish, McGill, Adelot, all of them. But I also read about our founders, the Hicksite Quakers. Now, as a scholar of religion, especially of progressive movements, I knew quite a bit about the Hicksite Quakers. I knew they were really visionaries when it came to education. They were visionaries and activists about social justice. They really imagined an America in which everyone had an opportunity for flourishing. But they also had a set of values that I think are in kind of the ground, the soil, the air, the water, the trees, the sky around Swarthmore. Sometimes it's kind of hidden, but it's there. And more it bubbles up. Values of equality, of community, of respect for others, of listening, of generous giving, of making the world a more just place, of speaking truth to power, even when the power is the college president, I've discovered, for the students. Important values that are more than ever needed, I think, in this day and age. Values the students are eager to hear about. So those are my kind of initial reflections. And I know they're brief because I want to save time for conversation. I want to hear about your experiences at Swarthmore. Where do we need to go in the next 10 and 20 years? What's going to be important for the students of today to learn? Many of you are alumni, some of you are parents, some of you are both. How will the current generation continue our tradition? But step back from the mirror. Feel free to step back from the Swarthmorean mirror. Let's talk about also where higher ed is going in this country. What kind of world we're going to be sending our graduates into. What do they need to know about the world out there? So again, just the beginning of a conversation. Yes, sir. Great. So the question is about consensus and as a form of decision making at Swarthmore, and how do I believe that it exists? When I was being interviewed for this position, it was a constant point that the search committee made, that the faculty made, that the students made. That the alumni made. And since I've been on campus, I have seen this way more than I have ever seen it on any other campus. And I'm going to give you one good example. Our endowment was down by about 16.8%, not the 30% that many schools face. 16.8% is still a loss, but it's actually quite good, thanks to Parker and others who established sound investment strategies for us. But that resulted in a gap for our budget, an adjustment of about $8 million that we had to make. We decided to make it by looking strategically, but also spreading the adjustment out around the community. That meant that we had to go to the faculty, and we said, here's how much you will have to cut the faculty budget by. I was scared of this. Having worked in the academy a long time, I know you can lay off staff, you can decrease facilities management. Very difficult to go to a faculty. But I have to tell you, it was totally amazing. The faculty came up with a plan, and I'm happy to explain that plan if someone wants me to. It is to reduce their faculty budget by about $1 million. They did it through civil conversation. They did it through rigorous discussion. They did it through listening to each other. And at the end, it was done through consensus. I simply cannot imagine that having been accomplished through consensus at any other school I know. So that the faculty could do it through such a difficult process says to me that consensus is very much still alive and well. The student groups are also attempting to operate through consensus, and the dean's office provides a lot of kind of training and education about what that means. Yes? That's such a good point, because I've seen that on other campuses too. I mean, even at Colgate, I wish we could kind of hire a calendar czar.
Yeah.
Because you'd bring in these really famous lecturers, faculty, and you'd get 5 students out. Because there'd be 25 events that night. So I do think that's key.
At the end of the semester,
right. Right. It's my sense is that it's that, you know, my sense is that it is a simpler calendar at Swarthmore. I also have an intuition, you probably can tell me this, if this is accurate or not, is that there is an incredible sense of support for one another in the community. So students really do go where their friends are to support them. We have 500 or 600 students that show up for a soccer game, for instance, both because it's fun and our soccer team is winning, but also because they know all the guys on the soccer team or the girls on the soccer team. So I think that size and learning to kind of support and help each other in community is also a real key factor. Yes, sir. You know, one of the things I've been hearing while I've been out on the road is this notion that we've just got to make sure our students really understand the global context. We have about 40% of our students who now study off campus. We've just hired a new director of our off campus study programs. About 7% of our students are international. And I think our faculty, as are many faculties in the U.S., are increasingly representing, you know, scholarship from around the globe or about the globe. So I do think that's a kind of changing trend in higher ed that we need to do. I like how Swarthmore does its, how we do our off-campus study program. There are two fundamental models in the U.S. So one model is that students from the school go with a faculty member from the school, and they live in a kind of off-campus study suburb. And they take a course from the faculty member from their home school, and maybe someone from the University of London or the University of Australia or somewhere. So it's kind of like you take the bubble and you transport it. But you do, I mean, there's some benefit because you're going to visit around and things like that. Swarthmore, in its typical fashion, makes a student prove that the academic course that they're going to take at the University of Ghana or wherever they're going is difficult and rigorous. And they go and live with a family in the local environment, and they take courses in the school. So I think it's a much more in-depth experience. But, you know, it takes a certain amount of courage for some of our U.S. students to do that. Yes, please. Very good. We may have to tape that speech for admissions.
You know, I mean,
it is kind of an interesting issue, because I think one of the number one, if the dean of admissions were here, he could have answered that question. That would have been good. But I think he would also say that the number one thing we hear from prospective students, we have a prospective student here tonight. Here she is, a prospective student, is that many prospective students worry that, A, they're going to work too hard, because we do have a generation that sometimes don't want to work very hard, but also that it's too serious, that it's not fun. And yet, you know, that is not true at all. If you come to the campus for an hour, you can see how much fun the students are having. Now, what's nice is that many of them are learning to have fun in ways other than just going to big parties. I mean, they're having fun in literary events or forming what they do call sci-fi clubs now or whatever. But they're having a full range of social experiences, and they're also very engaged, you know, in social transformation and finding that extremely meaningful. So if any of you have any suggestions of how we can get the word out that our students have tremendous amounts of fun, that would be appreciated. So prospective student, make sure you know students have lots of fun. We're here to testify. Yes, sir. Yeah. So the question is about, and I'm going to rephrase it, probably in my language, but it's one I'm equally passionate with you about, which is kind of the crisis of anti-intellectualism in this country and the dismissal of the value of a truly intellectual life. And I am very passionate about that. I think we are at a time of incredible anti-intellectualism this country, and we can rationalize it to death. We can say it's around the internet, it's whatever. As a historian of American culture, I just have to tell you, it's swung back and forth many times, and right now we are in a fairly anti-intellectual period. Not in all segments of society, but in many of them. So one of the things that really attracted me to Swarthmore was the notion that Swarthmore really could be the platform for a liberal arts undergraduate education as a place to really talk about the intellectual life and the value of it and the importance of it and why people go to college not just to get a job, but to train their minds, to cultivate a set of habits, to habituate themselves to appreciating culture of all types and of all depths. And of all ways. And I do think this is a national crisis. I mean, if you go back and you look at the founders of democracy and then you study kind of forward about the link of the liberal arts and democracy in this culture, it's always about kind of producing a thoughtful culture, a culture that knows how to build forward the conversation about who we are as an American people. And that takes deep thought. So I completely agree with you, and I think there are more and more presidents who are beginning to think that we have to find a way to become somehow, I guess the phrase is, public intellectuals ourselves in our own sphere and try to influence opinion and talk about it. So that's one of my great interests is, one, how to create public visibility for Swarthmore. Swarthmore is so well known in the higher ed community, and it's so well beloved by its alumni. But you get beyond that, and many people don't know what Swarthmore is. I mean, I've had friends say to me, so you left Colgate and you went to an upstate girls' school? Yeah. Right? So we need to get the visibility of Swarthmore known. But I would like to find a way to do that in a way that also pushes forward an image of life that really upholds thinking, the thoughtful living, the creative engagement with culture. I think it's a very important time in our culture for that. Okay, yes, ma'am. I think that is so true. And I think one of the things we also need to do is to encourage all of our alumni to proudly wear their Swarthmore identity, and to talk about it every chance they get. Yes, sir. Right. So I think that we're kind of running with the best of them in terms of teaching and technology tools. Most of our classrooms have are equipped with kind of smart classroom materials. Most of our faculty are using Blackboard. Not all. There are still some older faculty who are a bit uncomfortable with it, but I'm going in to help teach a course next week for one one seminar session, and, you know, I've been following the Blackboard materials and the chatter and the conversations. So I'm pretty comfortable with it. You know, it's a ever expanding game, right? I mean, the technology just keeps being created. Our library is really astounding. One of the things our current librarian has worked hard to do is to expand the relationship with the TRICO. We actually share some of the library staff among the tri-colleges, and that is such an advantage to us because we can move those books and those resources so quickly. We coordinate acquisition purchases. It has allowed us to expand wonderfully. We have a lot of media and technology people dedicated in the library themselves, so the students have very, very easy access to all sorts of sources. So I think we're very good. I think, you know, at some point we'll have to ask ourselves, do we want to add some kind of information commons? I think our physical space, we've not yet provided a kind of state-of-the-art information commons, which many schools have done. So I think that could be an opportunity or a challenge as we see in the future. But the faculty and the IT and the library staff seem, to me, at least as I compare them to schools I know very well from Colgate to Yale and Emory, very much where we would want them to be. I think Swarthmore has a history of not trying to be a leader in technology, but trying to very much keep up on the forefront. Mr. Lloyd. Yes. Thank you. You know, I so agree with you about this, students helping each other out. And some of it, sometimes there's some formal programs. We've just adopted the Science Associates, which are juniors and seniors, basically, who are trained by the science faculty to hold special classes, drills, whatever, in the evening to help with the retention in the sciences. But beyond that, I think it's probably a Quaker value that has lived and become so much a part of the culture. There is a radical equalitarianism in the culture among the students, and they really do help each other out. You know, everything is free, because they don't want anyone not to be able to go to something. The students all kind of dress the same. We have very few cars on campus, so the differences between the wealthy and the not so wealthy are not noticeable. And I think this creates an environment in which students really are free in a way to help one another, even as they're, you know, all working hard to do well in the classrooms. And I've not quite ever seen it to this level, and it's quite impressive. Yes, please. There is actually a weekly feature in the Phoenix on style. Yes, and it's really fascinating to me. It's you know, 1 week it'll be a boy, and 1 week it'll be a girl, and you can write in. It's not like there are journalists out there saying, "Oh, you have great style." So you write in and you say, "I want a picture of my favorite outfit," and it's just kind of interesting. And then they write and they interpret how they're expressing themselves through their clothes. I think your friend would have fit in well with her mind. So yes, please. I think that's what I hear all across the country, that if there's one term, it's just the rigor and the love of learning and the ability and the confidence to engage in thought and pushing thought and the willingness to spend hours to do that. So we're gonna take two more, and then there's more food and drink. So, okay, we'll take this one. We'll go three. I see three hands. This one, woman, man. Okay, please. So the question is really about the middle class and no loans and financial aid. I actually have just studied this pretty carefully because I was interested in that question too. I think de Tocqueville was right. The middle class is very important to mediate values. I think his insight is still true today. We actually give financial aid to many in the middle class. Our financial aid is spread fairly evenly, or I would say fairly smoothly. And I think that's been a tremendous commitment on our part. And we give a large amount of financial aid. And I know many in this room have contributed scholarship funds or annual funds. And thank you. It allows us to give access to everyone and also to make sure that we've got kind of de Tocqueville's dream of people at various from various backgrounds. When Swarthmore went to a loan-free policy several years ago, as far as I can tell by looking and analyzing the numbers, what that actually meant was we extended our loan-free for lower income to all students, to the middle class. So we don't require loans as part of the package for anyone at this point. I have to say, you know, we're looking carefully at our budget, and you know, we will try to keep that, but it's very, you know, financial aid is a very difficult one, and the loan-free is a very challenging one. But right now, and we're working hard to keep it, we have loan-free for everyone, which I think is really important. And I think there's only 20 schools that are need-blind, and of that 20, there may be 12 that are loan-free. So it's very rare in America. Correct. Loan-free means that we do not require loans as part of the financial aid package. They may still take on some loans, but it's usually fairly minimal because by that point they're getting a financial aid package. Okay, we had one more comment. We have two more comments. We'll go with the gentleman first. Okay. So the question is, what is the status of science at Swarthmore in general, and engineering in particular? We've invested heavily in the sciences. As you know, we built a new kind of new science facility. I told you about the science associates. We've invested heavily in teaching in the sciences. Our biology department, for instance, teaches one out of every 3 first-year students, which is actually an incredible statistic if you think about one department covering a third of the first-year class. The sciences are very strong. I don't know what's happening on other campuses, but we're seeing lots of students come in declaring pre-med again or going into biology or chemistry. So I think we've got lots and lots of interest in the sciences. I really like the fact that we have an engineering program. It was one of the things that attracted me. Having served on campuses such as Emory that are very, very strong in the sciences, on a graduate level, I realize engineering is really important to have represented. Our engineering program is strong in terms of the student enrollments. We're going to have to face that Hicks hasn't been remodeled for many, many years. In fact, what's his name, the guy who takes care of the machines?
Smitty.
Smitty, I think he's been there since time began, I really do. And he's nearing retirement, and we don't know what will happen when Smitty retires. So I think we've got some challenges facing us. I've recently been in contact with the dean of Olin Engineering School, and I hope to kind of work with him. I'm hoping that we can get the 5 or 6 programs together that approach engineering education like we do and form some kind of consortium. We're also trying to explore engineering and the support of engineering as a tri-code distinctiveness. The president of Haverford is very interested in our engineering program and how they can get Haverford students involved in it. He's a scientist. And the president of Bryn Mawr is very interested because it's a very attractive program for women's schools right now. So what I'm hoping is that we can kind of elevate and lift up our engineering program. But it's got some challenges, quite frankly, ahead, and they're around the facilities. And when you have weak science facilities, that means you have trouble recruiting faculty. So that's an area that will be a challenge or an opportunity as we move forward. Okay, final comment, and then we'll have some more social time. Yes. One of the several things that attracted me to Swarthmore was its focus on justice and outreach and ethics. And I think Swarthmore has long been very committed to ethical reflection and the sense of responsibility. And I think President Bloom used to talk about ethical intelligence and the importance of that. So I think faculty have several roles. One is an educational one of just teaching the traditions of ethical reflection and practice. And I think these can be taught in everywhere. It's the ethics of science. It's ethics in the religion courses. It's ethics in English, in the arts. I think there's a knowledge and a way of reflection that is key. I think another way, and probably a very important one on the undergrad, is as our students see our faculty engaged in ethical action, either on campus or from campus into the surrounding communities. The Lang Center now hosts a lot of service learning courses where the faculty literally use their academic courses to both reflect and master material and learn critical thinking, but also to engage and immerse and get involved in a community and come back and reflect. That is incredibly powerful for students. They get to see the faculty involved. They get to be part of a small ethical community. They get to learn the rigors of intellectual thought, but also kind of real life, what it means. So I think those are the ways right now that we see our faculty involved. We're having a very broad and very vigorous discussion on sustainability on campus, which is another way that the students are watching the faculty kind of engage with one another and with the students. It's a great question to conclude this part on, but we can continue, have a drink, have some more food, and talk some more.